a PowerPoint presentation, recorded the bumper numbers of all the vehicles involved, prodded surviving platoon members for more details, and built a whole storybook around the incident. But at the third level, the Senior Army Decoration Board, that still wasn't enough. The bureaucratic package was returned to Colonel Smith in December 2003. Perhaps the board had some sort of devil's advocate, a former decorated soldier from Vietnam who was not completely convinced, either of the story or that it merited the medal. At this point, the 3rd Infantry Division was going to assign another officer to follow up on the paper trail. Colonel Smith knew that if that happened, the chances of Sergeant Smith getting the medal would die, since only someone from Sergeant Smith's battalion would have the passion to battle the Army bureaucracy. The Army was desperate for metrics. How many Iraqis exactly were killed? How many minutes exactly did the firefight last? The Army, in its own way, was not being unreasonable. As Colonel Smith told me, everyone wants to award a Medal of Honor, but everyone is even more concerned with worthiness, with getting it right. There was a real fear that one unworthy medal would compromise the award, its aura, and its history. The bureaucratic part of the process is kept almost deliberately impossible to see just how committed those recommending the award are. Insufficient passion may indicate the award is unjustified. Nobody up top in the Army's command is trying to find Medal of Honor winners to inspire the public with, says Colonel Smith. It's the opposite. The whole thing is pushed up from the bottom to a skeptical higher command. Colonel Smith's problem was that the platoon members were soldiers, not writers. To get more details from them, he drew up a list of questions and made them each write down the answers, which were then used to fill out the narrative. Describe Sergeant Smith's state of mind and understanding of the situation. Did you see him give instructions to another soldier? What were those instructions? When the mortar round hit the M11383, where were you? What was Sergeant Smith's reaction to it? The answers came back in spades, Colonel Smith told me. Suddenly, he had a much fatter storybook to put into the application. He waited another year as the application made its way up to Personnel Command, Manpower and Reserve Affairs, the Chief of the Army, the Secretary of the Army, the Secretary of Defense, and the President. The queries kept coming. Only when it hit the level of the Secretary of Defense did Colonel Smith feel he could breathe easier. The ceremony in the East Room of the White House 2 years to the day after Sergeant Smith was killed, where President George W. Bush awarded the Medal of Honor to Sergeant Smith's 11-year-old son, David, was fitfully covered by the media. The Paul Ray Smith story elicited 96 media mentions for the 8-week period after the medal was awarded, compared with 4,677 for the supposed abuse of the Quran at Guantanamo Bay, and 5,159 for the disgraced Abu Ghraib prison guard Lindy England, over a much longer time frame that went on for many months. In a society that obsesses over reality TV shows, gangster and war movies, and NFL quarterbacks, an authentic hero like Sergeant Smith flickers momentarily before the public consciousness. It may be that the public, which still can't get enough of World War II heroics, even as it feels guilty about its treatment of Vietnam veterans, simply can't deliver up the requisite passion for honoring heroes from unpopular wars like Korea and Iraq. It may also be that, encouraged by the media, the public is more comfortable seeing our troops in Iraq as victims of a failed administration rather than as heroes in their own right. Such indifference to valor is another factor that separates an all-volunteer military from the public it defends. The medal helps legitimize Iraq for them. World War II had its heroes, and now Iraq has its, Colonel Smith told me, in his office overlooking the Mississippi River in Memphis, where he now heads the district office of the Army Corps of Engineers. Colonel Smith believes there are other Paul Smiths out there, both in their level of professionalism and in their commitment, each a product of an all-volunteer system now in its fourth decade. How many others have performed as valiantly as Sergeant Smith and not been recommended for the Medal of Honor? After all, had it not been for that brief respite in combat in the early days of the occupation of Baghdad, the process for the sergeant's award might not have begun its slow, dogged, and ultimately successful climb up the chain of command. Thinkers. 10. In Defense of Henry Kissinger. The Atlantic, May 2013. In the summer of 2002, during the initial build-up to the invasion of Iraq, which he supported, Henry Kissinger told me he was nevertheless concerned about the lack of critical thinking and planning for the occupation of a Middle Eastern country where, as he put it, normal politics have not been practiced for decades, and where new power struggles would therefore have to be very violent. Thus is pessimism morally superior to misplaced optimism. I have been a close friend of Henry Kissinger's for some time, but my relationship with him as a historical figure began decades ago. When I was growing up, the received wisdom painted him as the ogre of Vietnam. Later, as I experienced firsthand the stubborn realities of the developing world and came to understand the task that a liberal polity like the United States faced in protecting its interests, Kissinger took his place among the other political philosophers whose books I consulted to make sense of it all. In the 1980s, when I was traveling through Central Europe and the Balkans, I encountered A World Restored, Kissinger's first book, published in 1957, about the diplomatic aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars. In that book, he laid out the significance of Austria as a polyglot empire that could never be part of a structure legitimized by nationalism, and he offered a telling truth about Greece, where I had been living for most of the decade. Whatever attraction the war for Greek independence had held for the literati of the 1820s, it was not born of a revolution of middle-class origin to achieve political liberty, he cautioned, but a national movement with a religious basis. When policymakers disparage Kissinger in private, they tend to do so in a manner that reveals how much they measure themselves against him. The former Secretary of State turns 90 this month. To mark his legacy, we need to begin in the 19th century. In August 1822, Britain's radical intelligentsia openly rejoiced upon hearing the news of Robert Stuart's suicide. Lord Byron, the romantic poet and heroic adventurer, described Stuart, better known as Viscount Castlereagh, as a cold-blooded, placid miscreant. Castlereagh, the British Foreign Secretary from 1812 to 1822, had helped organize the military coalition that defeated Napoleon, and afterward helped negotiate a peace settlement that kept Europe free of large-scale violence for decades. But because the settlement restored the Bourbon dynasty in France, while providing the forces of liberalism little reward for their efforts, Castlereagh's accomplishment lacked any idealistic element, without which the radicals could not be mollified. Of course, this very lack of idealism, by safeguarding the aristocratic order, provided various sovereigns with the only point on which they could unite against Napoleon and establish a continent-wide peace, a peace, it should be noted, that helped Britain emerge as the dominant world power before the close of the 19th century. One person who did not rejoice at Castlereagh's death was Henry John Temple, the future British Foreign Secretary, better known as Lord Palmerston. "There could not have been a greater loss to the government," Palmerston declared, "and few greater to the country." Palmerston himself would soon join the battle against the United Kingdom's radical intellectuals, who in the early 1820s demanded that Britain go to war to help democracy take root in Spain, even though no vital British interest had been threatened, and even though this same intellectual class had at times shown only limited enthusiasm for the war against Napoleon, during which Britain's very survival seemed at stake. In a career spanning more than two decades in the Foreign Office, Palmerston was fated on occasion to be just as hated as Castlereagh. Like Castlereagh, Palmerston had only one immutable principle in foreign policy, British self-interest, synonymous with the preservation of the worldwide balance of power. But Palmerston also had clear liberal instincts. Because Britain's was a constitutional government, he knew that the country's self-interest lay in promoting constitutional governments abroad. He showed sympathy for the 1848 revolutions on the continent, and consequently was beloved by the liberals. Still, Palmerston understood that his liberal internationalism, if one could call it that, was only a general principle, a principle that, given the variety of situations around the world, required constant bending. Thus, Palmerston encouraged liberalism in Germany in the 1830s, but thwarted it there in the 1840s. He supported constitutionalism in Portugal, but opposed it in Serbia and Mexico. He supported any tribal chieftain who extended British India's sphere of influence northwest into Afghanistan toward Russia, and opposed any who extended Russia's sphere of influence southeast toward India, even as he cooperated with Russia in Persia. Realizing that many people, and radicals in particular, tended to confuse foreign policy with their own private theology, Palmerston may have considered the moral condemnation that greeted him in some quarters as natural. John Bright, the liberal statesman, would later describe Palmerston's tenure as one long crime. Yet without his flexible approach to the world, Palmerston could never have navigated the shoals of one foreign policy crisis after another, helping Britain, despite the catastrophe of the Indian Mutiny in 1857, managed the transition from its ad hoc imperialism of the first half of the 19th century to the formal, steam-driven empire built on science and trade of the second half. Decades passed before Palmerston's accomplishments as arguably Britain's greatest diplomat became fully apparent. In his own day, Palmerston labored hard to preserve the status quo, even as he sincerely desired a better world. He wanted to prevent any power from becoming so strong that it might threaten Britain, one of his biographers, Jasper Ridley, wrote. To prevent the outbreak of major wars in which Britain might be involved and weakened, Palmerston's foreign policy was therefore a series of tactical improvisations which he carried out with great skill. Like Palmerston, Henry Kissinger believes that in difficult, uncertain times, times like the 1960s and 70s in America, when the nation's vulnerabilities appeared to outweigh its opportunities, the preservation of the status quo should constitute the highest morality. Other, luckier political leaders might later discover opportunities to encourage liberalism where before there had been none. The trick is to maintain one's power undiminished until that moment. Ensuring a nation's survival sometimes leaves tragically little room for private morality. Discovering the inapplicability of Judeo-Christian morality in certain circumstances involving affairs of state can be searing. The rare individuals who have recognized the necessity of violating such morality, acted accordingly, and taken responsibility for their actions are among the most necessary leaders for their countries, even as they have caused great unease among generations of well-meaning intellectuals who, free of the burden of real-world bureaucratic responsibility, make choices in the abstract and treat morality as an inflexible absolute. Fernando Pessoa, the early 20th century Portuguese poet and existentialist writer, observed that if the strategist thought of the darkness he cast on 1,000 homes and the pain he caused in 3,000 hearts, he would be unable to act, and then there would be no one to save civilization from its enemies. Because many artists and intellectuals cannot accept this horrible but necessary truth, their work, Pessoa said, serves as an outlet for the sensitivity that action had to leave behind. That is ultimately why Henry Kissinger is despised in some quarters, much as Castlereagh and Palmerston were. To be uncomfortable with Kissinger is, as Palmerston might say, only natural. But to condemn him outright verges on sanctimony, if not delusion. Kissinger has in fact been quite moral, provided, of course, that you accept the Cold War assumptions of the age in which he operated. Because of the triumphalist manner in which the Cold War suddenly and unexpectedly ended, many have since viewed the West's victory as a foregone conclusion, and therefore have tended to see the tough measures that Kissinger and others occasionally took as unwarranted. But for those in the midst of fighting the Cold War, who worked in the national security apparatus during the long, dreary decades when nuclear confrontation seemed abundantly possible, its end was hardly foreseeable. People forget what Eastern Europe was like during the Cold War, especially prior to the 1980s. The combination of secret police terror and regime-induced poverty gave the impression of a vast, dimly lit prison yard. What kept that prison yard from expanding was mainly the projection of American power in the form of military divisions armed with nuclear weapons. That such weapons were never used did not mean they were unnecessary. Quite the opposite, in fact. The men who planned Armageddon, far from being the Dr. Strangeloves satirized by Hollywood, were precisely the people who kept the peace. Many baby boomers, who lived through the Cold War but who have no personal memory of World War II, artificially separate these two conflicts. But for Kissinger, a Holocaust refugee and U.S. Army intelligence officer in occupied Germany, for General Creighton Abrams, a tank commander under George Patton in World War II and the commander of American forces in Vietnam from 1968 onward, and for General Maxwell Taylor, who parachuted into Nazi-occupied France and was later the U.S. ambassador to South Vietnam, the Cold War was a continuation of the Second World War. Beyond Eastern Europe, revolutionary nihilists were attempting to make more Cubas in Latin America, while a communist regime in China killed at least 20 million of its own citizens through the collectivization program known as the Great Leap Forward. Meanwhile, the North Vietnamese communists, as ruthless a group of people as the 20th century produced, murdered perhaps tens of thousands of their own citizens before the first American troops arrived in Vietnam. People forget that it was, in part, an idealistic sense of mission that helped draw us into that conflict, the same well of idealism that helped us fight World War II and that motivated our interventions in the Balkans in the 1990s. Those who fervently supported intervention in Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia yet fail to comprehend the similar logic that led us into Vietnam are bereft of historical memory. In Vietnam, America's idealism collided head-on with the military limitations imposed by a difficult geography. This destroyed the political consensus in the United States about how the Cold War should be waged. Reviewing Kissinger's book, Ending the Vietnam War, 2003, the historian and journalist Evan Thomas implied that the essence of Kissinger's tragedy was that he was perennially trying to gain membership in a club that no longer existed. That club was the establishment, a term that began to go out of fashion during the nation's Vietnam trauma. The establishment comprised all the great and prestigious personages of business and foreign policy, all male, all Protestant, men like John J. McCloy and Charles Bolin, whose influence and pragmatism bridged the gap between the Republican and Democratic parties at a time when communism was the enemy, just as fascism had recently been. Kissinger, a Jew who had escaped the Holocaust, was perhaps the club's most brilliant protégé. His fate was to step into the vortex of foreign policy just as the establishment was breaking up over how to extricate the country from a war that the establishment itself had helped lead the country into. Kissinger became President Richard Nixon's National Security Advisor in January 1969 and his Secretary of State in 1973. As a Harvard professor and Rockefeller Republican, Kissinger was distrusted by the anti-intellectual Republican right wing. Meanwhile, the Democratic Party was slipping into the de facto quasi-isolationism that would soon be associated with George McGovern's "Come Home, America" slogan. Nixon and Kissinger inherited from President Lyndon Johnson a situation in which almost 550,000 American troops, as well as their South Vietnamese allies, at least 1 million soldiers all told, were fighting a similar number of North Vietnamese troops and guerrillas. On the home front, demonstrators, drawn in large part from the nation's economic and educational elite, were demanding that the United States withdraw all its troops virtually immediately. Some prominent American protesters even visited North Vietnam to publicly express solidarity with the enemy. The communists in turn seduced foreign supporters with soothing assurances of Hanoi's willingness to compromise. When Charles de Gaulle was negotiating a withdrawal of French troops from Algeria in the late 1950s and early 1960s, as Kissinger records in Ending the Vietnam War, the Algerians knew that if they did not strike a deal with him, his replacement would certainly be more hardline. But the North Vietnamese probably figured the opposite, that because of the rise of McGovernism in the Democratic Party, Nixon and Kissinger were all that stood in the way of American surrender. Thus, Nixon and Kissinger's negotiating position was infinitely more difficult than de Gaulle's had been. Kissinger found himself caught between liberals who essentially wanted to capitulate rather than negotiate, and conservatives ambivalent about the war who believed that serious negotiations with China and the Soviet Union were tantamount to selling out. Both positions were fantasies that only those out of power could indulge. Further complicating Kissinger's problem was the paramount assumption of the age, that the Cold War would have no end, and that therefore regimes like those in China and the Soviet Union would have to be dealt with indefinitely. Hitler, a fiery revolutionary, had expended himself after 12 bloody years, but Mao Zedong and Leonid Brezhnev oversaw dull, plodding machines of repression that were in power for decades, a quarter century in Mao's case, and more than half a century in Brezhnev's. Neither regime showed any sign of collapse. Treating communist China and the Soviet Union as legitimate states, even while Kissinger played China off against the Soviet Union and negotiated nuclear arms agreements with the latter, did not constitute a sellout, as some conservatives alleged. It was, rather, a recognition of America's eternal and perpetual interests, to quote Palmerston, refitted to an age threatened by thermonuclear war. In the face of liberal capitulation, a conservative flight from reality, and North Vietnam's relentlessness, Kissinger's task was to withdraw from the region in a way that did not betray America's South Vietnamese allies. In doing so, he sought to preserve America's powerful reputation, which was crucial for dealing with China and the Soviet Union, as well as the nations of the Middle East and Latin America. Sir Michael Howard, the eminent British war historian, notes that the balance of power ethos to which Kissinger subscribes represents the middle ground between optimistic American ecumenicism, the basis for many global disarmament movements, and the war culture of the American Wild West, in recent times associated with President George W. Bush. This ethos was never cynical or amoral, as the post-Cold War generation has tended to assert. Rather, it evinced a timeless and enlightened principle of statesmanship. Within 2 years, Nixon and Kissinger reduced the number of American troops in Vietnam to 156,800, the last ground combat forces left 3.5 years after Nixon took office. It had taken Charles de Gaulle longer than that to end France's involvement in Algeria. Frustration over the failure to withdraw even more quickly rests on two difficult assumptions: that the impossibility of preserving South Vietnam in any form was accepted in 1969, and that the North Vietnamese had always been negotiating in good faith. Still, the continuation of the war past 1969 will forever be Nixon and Kissinger's original sin. That successful troop withdrawal was facilitated by a bombing incursion into Cambodia, primarily into areas replete with North Vietnamese military redoubts and small civilian populations, over which the Cambodian government had little control. The bombing, called secret by the media, was public knowledge during 90% of the time it was carried out, wrote Samuel Huntington, the late Harvard professor who served on President Jimmy Carter's National Security Council. The early secrecy, he noted, was to avoid embarrassing Cambodia's Prince Narodom Sihanouk and complicating peace talks with the North Vietnamese. The troop withdrawals were also facilitated by aerial bombardments of North Vietnam. Victor Davis Hanson, the neoconservative historian, writes that, far from being ineffective and indiscriminate, as many critics of the Nixon-Kissinger war effort later claimed, the Christmas bombings of December 1972 in particular brought the communists back to the peace table through its destruction of just a few key installations. Hanson may be a neoconservative, but his view is hardly a radical reinterpretation of history. In fact, he is simply reading the news accounts of the era. Soon after the Christmas bombings, Malcolm W. Brown of the New York Times found the damage to have been grossly overstated by North Vietnamese propaganda. Peter Ward, a reporter for the Baltimore Sun, wrote, "Evidence on the ground disproves charges of indiscriminate bombing. Several bomb loads obviously went astray into civilian residential areas, but damage there is minor compared to the total destruction of selected targets." The ritualistic vehemence with which many have condemned the bombings of North Vietnam, the incursion into Cambodia, and other events betrays, in certain cases, an ignorance of the facts and of the context that informed America's difficult decisions during Vietnam. The troop withdrawals that Nixon and Kissinger engineered, while faster than de Gaulle's had been from Algeria, were gradual enough to prevent complete American humiliation. This preservation of America's global standing enabled the President and the Secretary of State to manage a historic reconciliation with China, which helped provide the requisite leverage for a landmark strategic arms pact with the Soviet Union, even as, in 1970, Nixon and Kissinger's threats to Moscow helped stop Syrian tanks from crossing farther into Jordan and toppling King Hussein. At a time when defeatism reigned, Kissinger improvised in a way that would have impressed Palmerston. Yes, Kissinger's record is marked by nasty tactical miscalculations, mistakes that have spawned whole libraries of books. But the notion that the Nixon administration might have withdrawn more than 500,000 American troops from Vietnam within a few months in 1969 is problematic, especially when one considers the complexities that smaller and more gradual withdrawals in Bosnia, Iraq, and Afghanistan later imposed on military planners. And that's leaving aside the diplomatic and strategic fallout beyond Southeast Asia that America's sudden and complete betrayal of a longtime ally would have generated. Despite the North Vietnamese invasion of eastern Cambodia in 1970, the U.S. Congress substantially cut aid between 1971 and 1974 to the Lon Nol regime, which had replaced Prince Sihanouk's, and also barred the U.S. Air Force from helping Lon Nol fight against the Khmer Rouge. Future historians will consider those actions more instrumental in the 1975 Khmer Rouge takeover of Cambodia than Nixon's bombing of sparsely populated regions of Cambodia 6 years earlier. When Saigon fell to the communists in April 1975, it was after a heavily democratic Congress drastically cut aid to the South Vietnamese. The regime might not have survived even if Congress had not cut aid so severely. But that cutoff, one should recall, was not merely a statement about South Vietnam's hopelessness. It was a consequence of Watergate, in which Nixon eviscerated his own influence in the capital and seriously undermined Gerald Ford's incoming administration. Kissinger's own words in Ending the Vietnam War deserve to echo through the ages. None of us could imagine that a collapse of presidential authority would follow the expected sweeping electoral victory of Nixon in 1972. We were convinced that we were working on an agreement that could be sustained by our South Vietnamese allies with American help against an all-out invasion. Protesters could speak of Vietnam in terms of the excesses of an aberrant society, but when my colleagues and I thought of Vietnam, It was in terms of dedicated men and women, soldiers and foreign service officers who had struggled and suffered there, and of our Vietnamese associates now condemned to face an uncertain but surely painful fate. These Americans had honestly believed that they were defending the cause of freedom against a brutal enemy in treacherous jungles and distant rice paddies. Vilified by the media, assailed in Congress, and ridiculed by the protest movement, they had sustained America's idealistic tradition, risking their lives and expending their youth on a struggle that American leadership groups had initiated, then abandoned, and finally disdained. Kissinger's diplomatic achievements reached far beyond Southeast Asia. Between 1973 and 1975, Kissinger, serving Nixon and then Gerald Ford, steered the Yom Kippur War toward a stalemate that was convenient for American interests, and then brokered agreements between Israel and its Arab adversaries for a separation of forces. Those deals allowed Washington to re-establish diplomatic relations with Egypt and Syria for the first time since their rupture following the Six-Day War in 1967. The agreements also established the context for the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty of 1979 and helped stabilize a modus vivendi between Israel and Syria that has lasted well past the turn of the 21st century. In the fall of 1973, with Chile dissolving into chaos and open to the Soviet bloc's infiltration as a result of Salvador Allende's anarchic and incompetent rule, Nixon and Kissinger encouraged a military coup led by General Augusto Pinochet, during which thousands of innocent people were killed. Their cold moral logic was that a right-wing regime of any kind would ultimately be better for Chile and for Latin America than a leftist regime of any kind, and would also be in the best interests of the United States. They were right, though at a perhaps intolerable cost. While much of the rest of Latin America dithered with socialist experiments, in the first 7 years of Pinochet's regime, the number of state companies in Chile went from 500 to 25, a shift that helped lead to the creation of more than 1 million jobs and the reduction of the poverty rate from roughly one-third of the population to as low as one-tenth. The infant mortality rate also shrank from 78 deaths per 1,000 births to 18. The Chilean social and economic miracle has become a paradigm throughout the developing world, and in the ex-communist world in particular. Still, no amount of economic and social gain justifies almost two decades of systematic torture perpetrated against tens of thousands of victims in more than 1,000 detention centers. But real history is not the trumpeting of ugly facts untempered by historical and philosophical context, the stuff of much investigative journalism. Real history is built on constant comparison with other epochs and other parts of the world. It is particularly useful, therefore, to compare the records of the Ford and Carter administrations in the Horn of Africa, and especially in Ethiopia, a country that in the 1970s was more than three times as populous as Pinochet's Chile. In his later years, Kissinger has not been able to travel to a number of countries where legal threats regarding his actions in the 1970s in Latin America hang over his head. Yet in those same countries, Jimmy Carter is regarded almost as a saint. Let's consider how Carter's morality stacks up against Kissinger's in the case of Ethiopia, which, like Angola, Nicaragua, and Afghanistan, was among the dominoes that became increasingly unstable and then fell in the months and years following Saigon's collapse, partly disproving another myth of the Vietnam anti-war protest movement, that the domino theory was wrong. As I've written elsewhere, including in my 1988 book, Surrender or Starve, the left-leaning Ethiopian dirge and its ascetic, pitiless new leader, Mengistu Haile Mariam, had risen to power while the United States was preoccupied with Watergate and the fall of South Vietnam. Kissinger, now President Ford's Secretary of State, tried to retain influence in Ethiopia by continuing to provide some military assistance to Addis Ababa. Had the United States given up all its leverage in Ethiopia, the country might have moved to the next stage and become a Soviet satellite, with disastrous human rights consequences for its entire population. Ford and Kissinger were replaced in January 1977 by Jimmy Carter and his Secretary of State Cyrus Vance, who wanted a policy that was both more attuned to and less heavy-handed toward sub-Saharan Africa. In the Horn of Africa, this translated immediately into a Cold War disadvantage for America, because the Soviets, spurred on by the fall of South Vietnam, were becoming more belligerent and more willing to expend resources than ever. With Ethiopia torn apart by revolutionary turmoil, the Soviets used their Somali clients as a lever against Addis Ababa. Somalia then was a country of only 3 million nomads, but Ethiopia had an urbanized population 10 times that size, excellent provender for the mechanized African satellite that became Leonid Brezhnev's supreme objective. The Soviets, while threatening Ethiopia by supplying its rival with weapons, were also offering it military aid, the classic carrot-and-stick strategy. Yet, partly because of the M-60 tanks and F-5 warplanes that Mengistu was still, largely thanks to Kissinger, receiving from the United States, the Ethiopian leader was hesitant about undertaking the disruptive task of switching munitions suppliers for an entire army. In the spring of 1977, Carter cut off arms deliveries to Ethiopia because of its human rights record. The Soviets dispatched East German security police to Addis Ababa to help Mengistu consolidate his regime and invited the Ethiopian ruler to Moscow for a week-long state visit. Then Cuban advisors visited Ethiopia, even while tanks and other equipment arrived from pro-Soviet South Yemen. In the following months, with the help of the East Germans, the Derg gunned down hundreds of Ethiopian teenagers in the streets in what came to be known as the Red Terror. Still, all was not lost, at least not yet. The Ethiopian Revolution, leftist as it was, showed relatively few overt signs of anti-Americanism. Israel's new prime minister, Menachem Begin, in an attempt to save Ethiopian Jews, beseeched Carter not to close the door completely on Ethiopia and to give Mengistu some military assistance against the Somali advance. But Begin's plea went unheeded. The partial result of Carter's inaction was that Ethiopia went from being yet another left-leaning regime to a full-fledged Marxist state, in which hundreds of thousands of people died in collectivization and villagization schemes, to say nothing of the hundreds of thousands who died in famines that were as much a consequence of made-in-Moscow agricultural policies as they were of drought. Ethiopians should have been so lucky as to have had a Pinochet. The link between Carter's decision not to play Kissingerian power politics in the Horn of Africa and the mass deaths that followed in Ethiopia is more direct than the link between Nixon's incursion into a rural area of Cambodia and the Khmer Rouge takeover 6 years later. In the late 19th century, Lord Palmerston was still a controversial figure. By the 20th, he was considered by many to have been one of Britain's greatest foreign ministers. Kissinger's reputation will follow a similar path. Of all the memoirs written by former American secretaries of state and national security advisors during the past few decades, his are certainly the most vast and the most intellectually stimulating, revealing the elaborate historical and philosophical milieu that surround difficult foreign policy decisions. Kissinger will have the final say precisely because he writes so much better for a general audience than do most of his critics. Mere exposé often has a shorter shelf life than the work of a statesman aware of his own tragic circumstances and able to connect them to a larger pattern of events. A colleague of mine with experience in government once noted that, as a European-style realist, Kissinger has thought more about morality and ethics than most self-styled moralists. Realism is about the ultimate moral ambition in foreign policy, the avoidance of war through a favorable balance of power. Aside from the successful interventions in the Balkans, the greatest humanitarian gesture in my own lifetime was President Richard Nixon's trip to the People's Republic of China in 1972, engineered by Kissinger. By dropping the notion that Taiwan was the real China, by giving China protection against the Soviet Union, and by providing assurances against an economically resurgent Japan, the two men helped place China in a position to devote itself to peaceful economic development. China's economic rise, facilitated by Deng Xiaoping, would lift much of Asia out of poverty. And as more than 1 billion people in the Far East saw a dramatic improvement in living standards, personal freedom effloresced. Pundits chastised Kissinger for saying in 1973 that Jewish emigration from the Soviet Union was not an American concern. But, as J.J. Goldberg of the Jewish Daily Forward was careful to note, even while being very critical of Kissinger's cynicism on the subject, emigration rose dramatically under Kissinger's détente policy, but plummeted after the 1974 passage of the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, which made an open emigration policy a precondition for normal U.S.-Soviet trade relations, aggrieved that the Americans would presume to dictate their emigration policies, the Soviets began authorizing fewer exit visas. In other words, Kissinger's realism was more effective than the humanitarianism of Jewish groups in addressing a human rights concern. Kissinger is a Jewish intellectual who recognizes a singular, unappealing truth, that the Republican Party, its strains of anti-Semitism in certain periods notwithstanding, was better able to protect America than the Democratic Party of his era, because the Republicans better understood and, in fact, relished the projection of American power at a juncture in the Cold War when the Democrats were undermined by defeatism and quasi-isolationism, that Kissinger-style realism is now more popular in Barack Obama's White House than among the GOP, indicates how far today's Republicans have drifted from their core values. But unlike his fellow Republicans of the Cold War era, dull and practical men of business, blissfully unaware of what the prestigious intellectual journals of opinion had to say about them, Kissinger has always been painfully conscious of the degree to which he is loathed. He made life-and-death decisions that affected millions, entailing many messy moral compromises. Had it not been for the tough decisions Nixon, Ford, and Kissinger made, the United States might not have withstood the damage caused by Carter's bouts of moralistic ineptitude, nor would Ronald Reagan have had the luxury of his successfully executed Wilsonianism. Henry Kissinger's classical realism, as expressed in both his books and his statecraft, is emotionally unsatisfying, but analytically timeless. The degree to which Republicans can recover his sensibility in foreign policy will help determine their own prospects for regaining power. 11. Samuel Huntington, Looking the World in the Eye. The Atlantic, December 2001. 1. The most memorable review that Samuel Phillips Huntington, the Albert J. Weatherhead III University professor at Harvard, ever got was a bad one. Imagine, Huntington recalled recently, sitting in his home on Boston's Beacon Hill. The first review of my first book, and the reviewer compares me unfavorably to Mussolini. He blinked and squinted shyly through his eyeglasses. Huntington, 74, speaks in a serene and nasal voice, the East Bronx modified by High Boston. He described how the reviewer, Matthew Josephson, writing in the left-wing opinion magazine The Nation, had ridiculed the militarism and brutal sophistries of the soldier and the state, and had sneered that Mussolini's sentiments had been similar, though his words had more panache. Believe, obey, fight. The review was published on April 6, 1957. The Cold War was scarcely a decade old. The soldier and the state constituted a warning. America's liberal society, Huntington argued, required the protection of a professional military establishment steeped in conservative realism. In order to keep the peace, military leaders had to take for granted and anticipate the irrationality, weakness, and evil in human nature. Liberals were good at reform, not at national security. Magnificently varied and creative when limited to domestic issues, Huntington wrote, liberalism faltered when applied to foreign policy and defense. Foreign policy, he explained, is not about the relationship among individuals living under the rule of law, but about the relationship among states and other groups operating in a largely lawless realm. The soldier and the state concluded with a rousing defense of West Point, which, Huntington wrote, embodies the military ideal at its best, a bit of Sparta in the midst of Babylon. The book enraged many of Huntington's colleagues in Harvard's Department of Government, and the following year the department denied him tenure. With his close friend Zbigniew Brzezinski, whom Harvard also did not promote, Huntington went off to teach at Columbia University. 4 years later, in 1962, Harvard invited both Huntington and Brzezinski back as tenured professors. Karl J. Friedrich, the German-born professor who had led the opposition to Huntington, met with him at Columbia. Friedrich talked of his admiration for the younger professor, until Huntington gently reminded him of his earlier hostility. It had become obvious to Friedrich and others that both Huntington and Brzezinski were rising stars in political science, and Harvard prided itself on its domination of the field. Brzezinski chose to stay at Columbia, but Huntington returned to Harvard, where he joined another rising star in the Department of Government, Henry A. Kissinger. The Soldier and the State, now in its 14th printing, went on to become an academic classic. Telford Taylor, the chief American prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials, had this to say about the book when it was first published. Civilian control of the military has become a piece of cant that politicians mouth worshipfully, but with little understanding. This is an area where iconoclasm is badly needed. Professor Huntington's store of this commodity seems virtually inexhaustible, and it is refreshing to follow his trail of destructive exposure. In recent decades, scholarly commentary has focused less on one aspect of Huntington's book and more on another, less on the need for the military's sense of realism and more on the threat a military may pose to civilian authority. Because democracies lack the disciplined political cadres that dictatorships produce, they are especially prone to subtle manipulation by powerful militaries. The Founding Fathers, Huntington observed, while providing for a separation of powers within civilian government, did not foresee the potential encroachment on civilian government of a gigantic defense establishment over time. The Soldier and the State initiated what has become a familiar pattern in Huntington's long career. His work has not immediately earned brilliant reviews and academic awards, but rather has garnered mixed reviews and harsh denunciations that ultimately yield to widespread, if grudging, acceptance. Even Huntington's enemies unwittingly define and worry about the world in ways and in phrases that originated with Huntington. Roger Hilsman, a specialist on Southeast Asia and a Huntington critic, complained in 1957 that many parts of The Soldier and the State are noisy with the sounds of sawing and stretching as the facts are forced into the bed that has been prepared for them. Well, maybe. Nonetheless, The Soldier and the State put the issue of civil-military relations on the map. The subject that Huntington has more recently put on the map is the clash of civilizations that is occurring as Western, Islamic, and Asian systems of thought and government collide. His argument is more subtle than it is usually given credit for, but some of the main points can be summarized. The fact that the world is modernizing does not mean that it is westernizing. The impact of urbanization and mass communications, coupled with poverty and ethnic divisions, will not lead to peoples everywhere thinking as we do. Asia, despite its ups and downs, is expanding militarily and economically. Islam is exploding demographically. The West may be declining in relative influence. Culture consciousness is getting stronger, not weaker, and states or peoples may band together because of cultural similarities rather than because of ideological ones, as in the past. The Western belief that parliamentary democracy and free markets are suitable for everyone will bring the West into conflict with civilizations, notably Islam and the Chinese, that think differently. In a multipolar world based loosely on civilizations rather than on ideologies, Americans must reaffirm their Western identity. The 2001 terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon highlight the tragic relevance not just of Huntington's ideas about a clash of civilizations, but of his entire life's work. Since the 1950s, he has argued that American society requires military and intelligence services that think in the most tragic, pessimistic terms. He has worried for decades about how American security has mostly been the result of sheer luck, the luck of geography, and may one day have to be truly earned. He has written that liberalism thrives only when security can be taken for granted, and that in the future, we may not have that luxury. And he has warned that the West may one day have to fight for its most cherished values, and indeed for physical survival, against extremists from other cultures who despise our country and who will embroil us in a civilizational war that is real, even if political leaders and polite punditry must call it by another name. While others who hold such views have found both happiness and favor working among like-minded thinkers in the worlds of the corporation, the military, and the intelligence services, Huntington has deliberately remained in the liberal bastion of Ivy League academia to fight for his ideas on that lonely but vital front. 2. The history of the intellectual battles surrounding American foreign policy since the early Cold War can be told, to an impressive degree, through Huntington's 17 books and scores of articles. Kissinger and Brzezinski have also produced distinguished works of scholarship, but these men will be remembered principally for their service in government, Kissinger as National Security Advisor under Richard Nixon and Secretary of State under Nixon and Gerald Ford, and Brzezinski as National Security Advisor under Jimmy Carter. Huntington, though he served briefly in the administrations of Lyndon Johnson and Carter, is a man of the academy to a far greater extent than his two friends. His ideas emerge from seminars and lectures, not from sudden epiphanies. If he couldn't teach, he probably couldn't write. And unlike many professors, he values his undergraduate students more than he does his graduate students. Graduate students, he told me, are more reluctant to challenge this or that professor, and have often been captured by the jargon and orthodoxy of the discipline. One of his former undergraduates observes, "Other academics want to ram down your throat what they know, and then go on to the next victim. Huntington never dominates classroom discussions, and he listens intensely." Huntington disdains rational choice theory, the reigning fad in political science, which assumes that human behavior is predictable, but which fails to take account of fear, envy, hatred, self-sacrifice, and other human passions that are essential to an understanding of politics. In an age of academic operators, he is an old-fashioned teacher who speculates historically and philosophically on the human condition. His former students include Francis Fukuyama, the author of the famous post-Cold War anthem The End of History and the Last Man, 1992, and Fareed Zakaria, the former managing editor of Foreign Affairs and the current editor of Newsweek International. You aren't likely to see Huntington on C-SPAN, let alone on the McLaughlin Group. He is a worse-than-indifferent public speaker, hunched over, reading laboriously from a text. His status and reputation have come the hard way, through writing books that, though often publicly denounced, have had a pervasive influence among people who count. Although he is the classic insider, a former president of the American Political Science Association and a co-founder of Foreign Policy magazine, he writes as an outsider, someone willing to enrage the very experts who will ultimately judge him. "If a scholar has nothing new to say, he should keep quiet," Huntington wrote in 1959. The quest for truths is synonymous with intellectual controversy. In many ways, Samuel Huntington represents a dying breed, someone who combines liberal ideals with a deeply conservative understanding of history and foreign policy. Huntington is a lifelong Democrat. He was a speechwriter for Adlai Stevenson in the 1950s and met his wife Nancy during the 1956 campaign, a foreign policy advisor to Hubert Humphrey in the 1960s, and one of the authors of Jimmy Carter's speeches on human rights in the 1970s. This same Huntington, though, is the founder of Harvard's John M. Olin Institute for Strategic Studies, a redoubt of foreign policy realism that has been financed by a triad of conservative philanthropies, the John M. Olin Foundation, the Smith Richardson Foundation, and the Bradley Foundation. When I suggested to Huntington that he is an old-fashioned Democrat, the kind that no longer exists, he indulged in a rare display of emotional animation. He snapped in reply, "That's it, that's what I am. As Arthur Schlesinger would say, I am a child of Niebuhr." Reinhold Niebuhr was the leading Protestant theologian of 20th century America, a devout Christian who believed that men are sufficiently wicked to require tough methods for the preservation of order. Huntington, an Episcopalian, was attracted to what he describes as Niebuhr's compelling combination of morality and practical realism. Though an ardent Cold Warrior, Niebuhr never succumbed to moral triumphalism, believing that history was more profoundly characterized by irony than by progress. "Even if the United States were to win the Cold War," Niebuhr wrote in 1952, "this outcome might only cause the nation to overextend itself, dissipating its power in an excess of righteousness." Niebuhr's tragic sensibility constitutes a thread connecting all of Huntington's major works. It is the key to Huntington's definition of conservatism. In the June 1957 edition of the American Political Science Review, Huntington published a monograph titled "Conservatism as an Ideology." "Liberalism," he wrote, "is an ideology of individualism, free markets, liberty, and the rule of law. Classic conservatism, in contrast, has no particular vision. It is a rationale, high and necessary, for ensuring the survival of liberal institutions." "Conservatism," Huntington observed, "is the rational defense of being against mind, of order against chaos." In England, he explained, Edmund Burke mounted a conservative defense of a commercial society and a moderate liberal constitution. "Real conservatism is about conserving what is, rather than crusading abroad for what is not or proposing radical changes at home." In the United States, Federalists like John Adams and Alexander Hamilton expounded conservative principles to defend a liberal constitution. "The American political genius," Huntington wrote, "is manifest not in our ideas, but in our institutions." And in his view, the greatest need is not so much the creation of more liberal institutions as the successful defense of those which already exist. 3. Samuel Huntington was born in 1927 in New York City, and grew up in middle-class housing projects in the Astoria section of Queens and in the East Bronx. He was the only child of Richard Thomas Huntington, a publisher of hotel trade journals, and Dorothy Sanborn Phillips, a short story writer, and he was the grandson of John Sanborn Phillips, the co-editor of the muckraking magazine McClure's. Huntington was a prodigy. He went to Yale from Peter Stuyvesant High School at age 16 and graduated with exceptional